Hello, we are Terra Nova, a horror podcast. We're hosted by Kendall and Jackie. And here we talk about everything, well, horror. And this podcast is specifically for you, the horror fans, and also the non-horror fans. If you're too scared to watch the movies, it's fine. We talk about it, we discuss it, we dissect it, we laugh about it, talk about the good, the bad, the tropes, and new episodes are launched every Monday.
And follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Terra Nova Pod. And leave a review, 5 stars, of course, on what platforms that you listen. And last but not least, tell a friend, tell a friend, tell a friend.
And tell your dog, too. Cujo. Hello.
Hello.
I like how your hello always changes. Like, every episode we do, it's either hello, or like, hello, or hello.
Yeah, if I knew multiple languages, I'd do it in a different language every episode, but I don't.
Well, I do that with lie. Whenever someone's lying to me, I'm like, or I'm questioning life, I'll be like, ¿por qué? Why? Or someone's saying something in Spanish. I knew how to say, like, lie in other languages, but I forgot. I knew how to say no in different languages, too, but I forgot. Because I used to say it in multiple languages just to be extra. But if someone's like... If someone tells me some weird fact, and I'm like, you lie. Mentiras. So, yeah, I do that.
That sounds so dramatic. That sounds like a Telemundo episode or something. That's a telenovela.
Yeah, it's always the same thing. The epic, angry verb, and then a pencil drops, or a cup is on the floor, or something breaks. Always something's breaking or falling on the floor. That's just the formula. And then cutscene. Yeah, and then cutscene, mm-hmm. And then you're back to the whole, like, so, yeah. Gotta love my soap operas.
Yeah, I used to watch them, too, even though I had no idea what the hell was going on. I was just like, sure, why not? We're here. I'm like, I need to ask for subtitles. You don't give a fuck about non-Spanish-speaking audiences.
I know, and they'd be really good. Some of them are crazy storylines. Some of them are zany, but some of them be really, really good. They're just like, oh, my God. You get so invested, and you're just like, damn, Maria. Shit.
You're like, you telling me Jeff is his own father? I don't even know how that's possible.
My whole life is a lie. Like, yeah, you get so invested, and you're just like, damn, what do I do with my life now? But speaking about drama, it's March. It is Women's Month. So power to Black Indigenous women of color. Also, people who have vaginas, power to you. We can't forget you. This is your recommendation, which I'm fresh off it. Like, I just finished watching this movie. And, wow. So, the film that my lovely co-host recommended that we do for this month is Hush, 2016, directed by Mike Flanagan. And also written and co-written by both Mike and lead actress, Kate Siegel. And I was telling Kendall before I recorded, I was like, I know that actress. I even wrote in my notes. I was like, I love her as an actress. I've seen her so many things. Such a good actress. But yes. So let me go into the summary because I have a lot to say about this movie. Being that it's my first time watching this film.
I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah. So yes, Hush. Hush starts off with Maddie, who we find out in the very beginning, actually, she is deaf and mute. And how we find out is amazing sound and editing. She's cooking food, and then all of a sudden the sound changes to the point that you're in her viewpoint and you hear absolutely nothing. You see everything, but you hear nothing at all. You just hear what she hears, which is muffled sounds. Afterwards, she's, you know, getting messages from her friend Sarah. She comes by. She was just like, oh my God, you wrote an amazing book. Because apparently Maddie is a successful thriller writer. Not really sure what genre they said that she writes, but I think it's thriller.
Yeah, it seems like thriller, possibly horror.
Yeah, and so Sarah said, oh my God, the book was amazing. I love the twist. I love that. Like, you're a great storyteller. And all while they're conversating through ASL, sign language. And Sarah, who's still kind of new to it, you know, she kind of like says certain things wrong, and you know, Maddie just laughs at her and just corrects her in a very friendly way, because you could tell that like, they've been friends for years because of the way they interact. Yeah. So they're having their whole conversation. You know, she was, you know, kind of emphasizing the fact that she kind of compliments Maddie in a way where she's like, you know, you're a great storytelling despite what happened to you. You know, I'm sorry about what happened to you for your disease. But you're such a good, you know, writer. And I can't wait for your next book. And when it focuses on a novel that she gave Sarah to borrow, but then she later told her to keep it, I have a whole bunch, you know, in the attic. You find out that her deafness was not something that she was born with. She was diagnosed with, I believe, a form of meningitis, bacterial yep. meningitis, that I think it messed up her throat, made her mute. And then through surgery, there were complications, and therefore it made her deaf at 13. This is wild. That's just like, when I read that in the little biography, I was like, that's crazy. Yeah. But also scary, because sometimes stuff like that really happens in complications. Like, you get something and then something else messes up in the long run. It's crazy. But yeah, so you find that out. She also, you hear that this really loud-ass fire alarm going off because, you know, she's cooking. You know, she kind of forgot about it because, you know, Sarah was talking to her. You know, they quickly defuse it. And Sarah's just like, it's a really loud, like, fire alarm. And she's like, yeah, it's loud because I need to feel their vibrations. If I don't, you know, who knows what could happen. It wakes her up. So that was pretty yeah. interesting to know about that fact about her. She briefly mentions this person named Craig who keeps calling her. You're like, who's that? She also mentioned that how when she's writing the book, she tends to hear an inner monologue, but the inner monologue she's hearing is actually her mother's voice. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I thought that was funny.
Yeah. And so Sarah leaves. You know, Maddie goes back with her day. She's throwing out her food that tasted really bad. Her face when she was making, I don't know, I think she was making rice or some type of dish. And I'm like, girl, that's yeah. my face. That's my face when I'm tasting stuff. And I'm like, nope, this is not good. What did I do?
Yeah, she was trying some recipe she saw online.
Yeah, and I'm just like, yeah, not working. I'm like, I feel you. I do that too. But yeah, so she's doing with that day. And then boom, action happens. Sarah is being murdered. She's screaming out loud, like, you know, hear me, see me, please. But the glass, I love how Maddie's house, all the windows, the glass doors is all plexiglass. And plexiglass cannot break that easily. It's very hard. It's kind of soundproof and whatnot. And while this is happening, you know, Maddie's throwing out her food. She's washing things. Sarah's being gutted. The killer, you almost see his, he's wearing a mask, but his eyes alone kind of give the express of like, I'm stabbing this girl so many times and you don't notice it. And then that's when he starts to realize, oh shit, she can't hear me. And I think that's when he's just like, yeah. All right, I'm going to play around with this. So Maddie, totally disregarding the fact that her best friend was killed in front of her porch and dragged off, you know, she goes to try to finish her next novel. She's in a monologuing to herself, and this time we hear her actual voice about how, like, it's gonna be a failed project, gonna be this, gonna be that, which I think we all do when we're working on something.
Yeah, you get the writer's block or a creative block, you're like, oh, this shit sucks.
Yeah, and you're like, time to end this and just do a real job. And I'm like, yeah. Yep, feel that, I felt that. But yeah, so while that's happening, she gets a FaceTime call from her sister. They're talking. And while this is happening, the killer ends up, like, sneaking into her house. And again, since Maddie is deaf, she does not hear this. She doesn't hear anything. And he's, like, making noise with his knife. She still sees that how she doesn't hear him. And so he ends up taking her phone, and in that instance, her sister's just like, hey, I saw something, what's that? And she's like, you know, sign language, like, what are you talking about? And Maddie thinking, oh, maybe it's the cat, you know, the cat kind of ran off, so let me go look for her. Again, totally not knowing the fact that there is this crazy man in her house. Yep. And so she's looking around, she's, you know, like, what's going on, what's this? And then she gets pictures from her own phone, and she's like, what the hell? Like, her face alone said, what the hell's going on?
Yeah, and her face was like, goddamn.
Yeah, and you see that how this masked man has been taking pictures of her from outside the window, and she's like, what? And then she finally sees him standing outside the door, but the door has been open because she thought, well, it's the cat. And that's when the big chase happens. In a way, she runs to close the door, he unmasks himself, and you can clearly see that she does not recognize him at all, otherwise she'd be like, but no, she's just like, what the hell's going on? He cuts the light off, he cuts everything off, her internet, any way of communicating. He slices like her tire so she can't even drive anywhere. And then, you know, he starts talking to her. He's like, can you read my lips? And then he tells her, like, oh, you know, we're going to have fun. You have nowhere to go, but I'm not going to get you yet. I'm going to get you when you want to die. I'm going to say this, like, I have not felt this much fear watching a movie since Black Christmas, the 1970 original. Like, the whole time, my chest, my chest was so tight watching this movie, because I was just like, oh my god. And you can see her face, like, she's freaking out. She's like, oh my god. And the fact that she's isolated as well, because you do find out that in the beginning, when her sister are talking about it, her sister's just like, oh, you're in the middle of nowhere. And she tells her, like, this wasn't by choice. I'm here, not by choice.
Well, she did say it was by choice. She said she chose to come out there.
Oh, really? I thought she said it wasn't by choice.
Yeah, her sister wanted her to come back to the city, but she was like, her sister made it seem like she kind of ran away from city life. But she was like, no, I came here by choice. It was a decision to come here.
Okay,
I wanted to do it myself. She was like, the city's too loud.
Oh, yeah. And she laughed about that. She's like, oh, Maddie.
Yeah.
But yeah, so basically, the whole rest of the movie ends up being a cat and mouse chase of the killer trying to kill Maddie in any way he can. Maddie trying to outwit the killer. And I gotta say, like, she does a really damn good job at that. Like, she thinks of everything, even though the fact that she is deaf and mute, and he does utilize that a lot. He likes to emphasize that by teasing her, by making noises that he knows she cannot hear. And he's just like a sick man. Like, he seemed like a hunter, because when at one point he has a bow and arrow, they have a whole interaction where she ends up, like, he tries to break in, she stabs him with the back part of a hammer, and she manages to steal his bow and arrow, and she sees that he etched in, like, these numbers on the side of it. I'm assuming the many things that he has killed with that bow and arrow, whether it's human or not. And she does everything in her power to, like, find a way to, like, escape and get out. And, you know, he basically torments her. He tries to knock on the window, and she's just like, you know, what's going on? And he's holding the body of Sarah that he killed, which, you know, of course, disturbs Maddie, of course. You know, she's hyperventilating. And there's a certain point when Sarah's husband comes by. And he dresses himself as her boyfriend, but I think that was her husband. And he was just like, oh, I'm looking for, you know, Sarah, and blah, blah, blah. And the guy, the killer, he said what his name was, I think. But I don't remember what he said.
Oh, no, he didn't say his name. He didn't say his name. Because it's funny, even in IMDb, he doesn't have a name. Yeah, the boyfriend says his name, but the killer never says his name at any point in the movie, which didn't realize until, like, just now.
Let's just call him the hunter. He's the hunter. Yeah. Let's call him that.
In IMDb, he's listed as the man.
But that's funny. But yeah, so the hunter, he ends up trying to make up this whole scenario that how he's I guess a watchman in a way, like a community watchman. He was like, oh, we got this. No, he says that how he is a deputy in training. He got a call. There was someone calling, something broke in, blah, blah. He's just making this whole elaborate story. And then Sarah's husband, John, looks at this and then sees, like, a little, like, I think blood or necklace that Sarah had that was on the floor. And he's basically humoring the story, but also knowing that how he's lying. Because then he's like, well, who will call? Because Maddie's deaf and mute. how is that possible? Yeah. Like, oh, maybe it was Sarah. And then all the while, he's still trying to gear up to attack this man with the rock. But then it kind of all fails when Maddie is like banging on the door, the glass door, kind of warning John. And then, boop, he gets stabbed in his neck and a vital artery because he's just bleeding out. But he does manage to try to restrain the hunter. And with his words, you know, since she could read lips, he's like telling her, run, run, run. And then at the moment, she has this whole inner monologue to herself about survival. That was like chef's kiss for me. Because we never see that in horror movies. We never see when they're... We see when they're thinking with their movements, but never like their inner thoughts of what they're thinking at that moment. I thought it was really clever that Mike wanted to put that in the film the way he did. Because she's like, you know, okay, scenario this. You run out, you get this, but boom, he'll stab you and he kills you. Scenario two, you're running in the crawl space, he finds you, he kills you. You bleed to death, you this and that. And then she's like, what is, you know, several endings? What is the best scenario? And then she's like, I have to kill him.
Yeah.
And it was the most badass moment to me at the very ending when she ends up like, I'm gonna kill this guy any way I can. You know, she shoots him with the bow and arrow when he's about to kill her cat. You know, she drops one of the arrows. He chases after her, breaks her hand in a very unnerving way because you're hearing the bones break.
Yeah.
But she gets, you know, her badassness and she was like, come in, do it, do it. You know, she's trying to break the glass. She's writing a little note that if something were to happen, she describes him vividly so that way the cops will see that and they will know. If something were to happen to her and he got away, they will find this guy. So she's definitely thinking two steps ahead. Like, in a worst case scenario, if I die, I need to describe who this person was. And so she's doing that. She hides in the bathroom. She's, like, ready with the knife. And then you see that he ended up crawling through some space. Broke. At first, I was like, is that water? But it was the wall. It was the ceiling. He broke it somehow and got into the shower. He's like about to stab her, mimicking her like, oh, you know, I bet you if I stabbed you at one point, I could make you scream. And then his biggest mistake was breathing on her, forgetting that because she's deaf and mute. Her other senses are totally heightened. She feels it, stabs him, runs away. You know, he's choking her. She's slightly dying. But then she gets a corkscrew, stabs into the neck. He's like, you know, still clenching into her. You know, he dies, falls over, and then you're thinking she's dead. And then she has this huge gasp of air that she breathes. She calls the 911, and it's smart because the sound of the alarm, you don't hear it, but you know it's still going off. So these cops. Yeah. You know, I'm sure they do have, like, an option for those who have disabilities that they can, like say what happened. But I'm sure the alarm alone they're hearing is just like, whoa, something's going on. So she goes and she waits for him, waits for the cops in the most successful, like, I did it type of thing. Like, I survived, and then that was it.
Yeah.
Cut the credits, and wow. Like, that was such a good fucking movie.
I'm happy you enjoyed it.
Wow. Yeah, I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. This is one of the movies where I was like, I don't think I'm never sure. I'm never sure how someone would feel about this movie. Because it is like, it's a survival horror. And if you've seen one, you've seen most survival horrors. Like, you know, from like Funny Games, The Strangers. Like, there's a laundry list of like survival horror movies or home invasion type horror movies. So it's like, I don't crap on the genre, but you know, it's a little bit of I've seen one, I've seen most of them. It's like hard to kind of remix it. But yeah, this one definitely remixed it in like an interesting enough way that it's memorable. So that's part of the reason I recommended it. I was like, I have a feeling Jackie probably never seen this movie. So let me recommend this one.
Yeah, because I was like, Kendall, I was like, it's on Netflix for anyone who's interested in watching it. So I watch a lot of horror movies on Netflix, or even horror TV on Netflix. And you know, they always have those like, because you watched, and they'll recommend stuff, and I've always seen it. But I never really had interest to watch it, because like you said, it just seemed like another home invasion film. And I'm like, well, I've seen them all, probably the same thing. But since we're recovering the episode, you know, of course I had to watch it. But it was definitely very interesting and unique how they did it. And I like how that Mike Flanagan said that how he was inspired by Wait Until Dark, 1967 with Audrey Hepburn, where I think it was her first horror role that she's ever done. Because Audrey Hepburn, you know her as like the drama actress who's always doing, you know, romantic films, dramatic films. And that was the first time people saw her in a horror type lighting. And I remember when that film first came out, mainly because, you know, thanks to, you know, all these networks like AMC and Shudder, they always have like these lists of greatest horror movies or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I remember someone was talking about this film because when it first came out, and again, this goes back to advertising and promoting, there's a scene in the film where she cuts off all, because Audrey Hepburn's character is blind. She's mm-hmm. a disabled blind woman. These men break into her apartment because they think that she has this type of like doll that's harboring like amounts of drugs in there. So they break into her house. And when they realize that she is blind, similar to this, they try to take advantage of that. But she puts the upper hand on them by cutting off all the lights. And when that happened in theaters before the movie starts, in the mid-scene intermission, a black screen happens and dialogue comes out and it says, "The light's been cut off. Sorry for this. This is part of the movie. Please do not be frightened. Do not be scared." And then the movie comes back on. And then you see her struggle and trying to survive, and she does end up surviving. And that's what reminds me of this, where like people have said that when they saw that film, they were so scared for Audrey Hepburn that she did such a good job. They thought she really was blind.
That's dope.
And they
I need to check
terrified
that out.
Yeah, it's a very good film. And I like how he said that he was influenced by it because you could tell, you know, the man basically took a, like, he pointed out several times in the movie that he knows that she cannot hear him by scratching the knife against the glass, which was so unnerving for the audience because we can hear that. She can't. Yeah. Tapping the glass, tapping his knife and all this stuff. Like, he can hear all this. We can hear this. She can't. Just toying with her mentally because he knows that she can't really hear him. So he's just playing with her, like as if she, like, I mean, she is prey to him. And it was just so, he was so sick. And I was just like, man, I hope you die. horrible. But yeah, it was definitely a good film. I really liked the film a lot. Like, it was just really well done.
Yeah, word. It is. And I think that's why it's memorable to me. Like, super small cast, only 5 people.
Yes.
Yeah, we're 5 people. So super small cast. I think the movie barely runs an hour and a half, if even that. But and it takes place entirely in one location. For anyone who hasn't seen it, it's all her house. It's pretty much outside her house and inside the house. That's the entire movie. But it's a good movie. It's an easy watch. It's fun in some ways. It's unnerving in other ways. It's interesting because it's not quite the, like, I don't know. I think the first time I saw this movie, because this is only probably my third time seeing it. Oh, wow. I don't know what I expected from it. I heard about it because I think when it first came out, it was getting high praise. I think at South by Southwest or something like that. One of those movie festivals, it was getting high praise. So like randomly passed my Netflix recommendation or something. And I was like, okay, I'll check it out. Mm-hmm. That sounds interesting. And it's funny, the first, like, 15 seconds when the movie comes on, I thought my TV was broke because it's complete silent.
Oh, my God, me too. Me too. I literally put up the volume like a dumb bitch. And so when the title card came in, it was like, boom. I was like, oh, my God, I got to lower this.
Yeah. The first, like, about 15 seconds. Because this is a Blumhouse movie. So, you know, they have the little Blumhouse promo intro where, like, they show you the crazy characters and stuff like that and all stuff happening in the house. And, you know, normally that has sound. So it comes on and you're just like, why is it quiet? Like, is that music TV by accident? And then it shows you a few other promo intros and you're like, why is it still silent? And then it just cuts to the title screen where it says hush and it's just a loud bang. I guess that was their way of reaffirming, like, no, your TV ain't broke. We did that on purpose.
I know, which was really clever. Very clever on the part. And thinking about sounds, I love how, First of all, when I read some of the articles, I just gotta say this. Props to Mike Flanagan and to Kate Siegel for getting an actual deaf consultant on set. Because not only did he go over the script with them, he also basically, he taught Kate how to do ASL. And he also kind of like changed some of the narrative for the script. Originally, she was going to be born deaf, Maddie. But the deaf consultant was just like, no, let's make it more interesting. Let's make it so that she lost her senses later in life. Which, I think that it did a big deal for it. But also the
fact that made that decision?
I think because the show, and I remember I read an article that said that how like whenever any of us lose one of our senses, even if like for a short time period, we do freak out. We have no idea what the hell to do. And then for those who lose it permanently later in life, we kind of have to relearn how to do our normal things. Like we're a newborn, but in a different way now. And I feel like the way they did that was to show that how, well, she did hear, she did speak, but because of what happened to her, she had to basically relearn it. And then I love how there's an article that described it as in like, it made it feel like she felt so isolated herself because of what happened to her that that's why she moved to an isolated area where it's like, I don't belong in this loud world because first of all, you don't hear me. You don't see me. I can't hear you. So let me just take myself out and just be in an environment where I feel my new normal now. That's how I took it. I think that's what they did it.
Yeah.
And I find it interesting when they do that, a character similar to the Advent Calendar, you know, the French film where the woman, she wasn't born as a paraplegic.
Yeah.
You know, she had an accident and so she could never use her legs. And so she had to relearn how to live a normal life without her usage of her legs. But she remembers what they felt. She remembers the sensation of dancing and doing all this stuff. And similar to Maddie, like, she knew it. And that's why I love how when she does her inner monologue, you do get a chance to finally hear her. Because that's what she hears. She hears herself talking to her. So,
no, yeah, that's really interesting. That's a good point. Yeah, that's a really good point. Because I was wondering about that when I was reading it, too. I was like, so they told him to change that? But I was like, I wonder why. Like, but I'm guessing it was probably all the reasons you just stated. Because, yeah, it does make sense if you were born... If you were born in, with that condition, then it's just your normal. You didn't know what it was like to not have it. But to be born with with all your senses and then lose them, yeah, that is a drastic change. Definitely a learning adjustment. So, that yeah, and that kind of adds a little more depth to the scenes, like when she forgot the food was cooking. Because she's probably used to hearing it. Used to hearing the sound of, like, burning or hearing something going off and things like that. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting. That is a good point. Because I was just wondering about that. That was just a thought that kind of came to my mind the whole time because watching it, I was like, she seems to be kind of fairly adjusted to the situation. But I guess, you never know how well adjusted you are until you end up in certain things. Like, it wasn't until basically, at the end of the movie when she gave herself that pep talk, where she kind of realized, well, I can't hear, but he can, and I can use that against him. So
Yeah, that was just like, when she used that alarm, I was just like,
yeah, that alarm was loud as hell. Yeah, that alarm was crazy loud. I was like, yeah, that would, if you aren't deaf, it would probably make you deaf as loud as that alarm was. And the flashing lights, it was like, this was just like sensory overload.
Well, yeah. I really appreciated that as well. But also with the sound, I like how we didn't hear much of a score at times. I love how Mike and his crew, and I guess the consultant as well, wanted to keep it as if, like, we can hear things. Like, when she's running the grass, we hear that. When she's trying to sneak atop of the roof, we hear that. She doesn't hear that she's trying to be quiet, but we can hear it. Yeah. And certain things that she does, and like, certain movements, like, I love how there wasn't any score over her running over the grass. There wasn't any score of her, like, moving things or running places. Like, I liked that because you could really hear what was going on in a sense. She can't, but you can.
Yeah, it definitely adds different, like, dynamic there when, like you said, when her running away, I'm not even sure if she's conscious of being quiet because she can't hear how loud she is. Mm-hmm. Like, she's just, she knows that running in leaves or running between leaves should make sound, but she can't be, she can't, because of her condition, she can't be conscious of how loud it actually is compared to what he would probably be hearing. Because if she was aware, she definitely probably could have snuck away. She had, like, at least, what, probably 6 different exits, ways to get out of the house, like a window almost in every corner of the building for her to get out. Mm-hmm. She had crawl spaces. A lot of things she could have totally, like, used against him to get away, even into, like, just into the woods, where it would be harder for him to trace her. But, you know, because she couldn't weaponize sound, she couldn't really truly dynamic. And she tried it once or twice, but, like, not to the best success.
Yeah, that's why she was having those scenarios in her head. Basically talking to herself, and she like, scenario this, you do this.
Yeah, and that scene was great for a mm-hmm. lot of reasons, but I think it was probably the reason why it stands out in my head is because it was one of the more unique ways you kind of seen a character arrive at the conclusion that, like, yo, I need to kill this person. But I feel like normally with, like, a lot of survival horror movies like this, you get the character who's kind of going through all of this shit for like an hour or so, and then in the last 5 minutes, they just kind of like stand up and go, fuck this, I'm a fight. And like, they'll kind of just say it, or they'll kind of have like a moment where you just realize their actions start changing a little bit more. And I think because we can hear those characters, like, they, like, you know, they can talk, we kind of get like, oh, like, their tone is like shifting, and they're kind of arriving at that point. Where here, the girl is deaf and mute, so I feel like she started fighting from the beginning, but I think just her level of fight kind of rose over the course of the movie to the point where it was just like, okay, we can now, when the prep talk came, and it was kind of like, oh, now we're like finally inside of her head, and we can hear the voice that she hears when writing the stories that she even writes, which, you know, some people had that whole theory about this stuff being fake, everything being fake, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah, because she's a writer, so they were like, maybe this is part of her story. They were just living through a story. But, I mean, I kind of thought that in a sense when she basically turned her head and she was just like, now you die. And I'm like, wait, what? Is it an illusion? What's going on? but it was just her, yeah, giving her pep talk of like giving her the different scenarios. If you run, he's going to kill you. The longer you take trying to throw the bow because you can't use it, he's going to use it to stab you. You crawl in a crawl place, he can't fit there, but if he sees you, he's going to drag you out and kill you. If you try to turn the lights on, he's going to find you and he's going to kill you. Like, every scenario was broken down because, again, she's a writer. So she knows how to really narrate her own life in the way she does with her characters. Where she's like, if I do this, this is going to... That's why she said that, how, like, there's so many different endings. But none of them work. And that's when she basically told herself, like, I have to kill him. That's the only way I'm out of this. That's the only way I'm going to survive this.
Yeah.
It was just so, again, because like I said, like, we've seen this. We've seen this in so many survival movies where you see the main lead, whether it's male or female, and you see them gathering things that you know they're going to fight back. But we never get a chance to be in their head of what they're thinking about. Sometimes we do, and sometimes we don't. So it was nice to see that and to hear that. Her having the whole, like, okay, if I do this, then the effect is that, but that doesn't work. If I do this way, no, it's not gonna work that way. But that, I thought that was definitely really cool. Very, very cool.
Yeah, that scene reminded me a lot of you ever saw Funny Games?
Yeah.
I think I've only seen the remake. I don't think I've ever seen the original, but there was a scene.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know the remake. I didn't see
I think the remake, from what I've heard, it's pretty much almost scene by scene exactly the same as the original. But I'll check out the original at some point. But there's a scene in Funny Games where, what was it? The family, you know, Funny Games, for people who've never seen it or heard of it, it's basically another home invasion type movie, except it's like these two preppy suburban white kids who, like, decide to just terrorize this family who just moved into the neighborhood. And it's like two of them against basically three because it's the husband, the wife, and the child. And they just kind of terrorize them with, like, anything from, like, golf clubs, weapons, guns, everything. They terrorize them. And there's a scene in the movie where, like, there's a gun sitting on the table, and, like, they're, like, sitting across from each other on the table. They're, like, basically the villains versus, like, our protagonists. They're, like, sitting across from each other. And the lady gets, like, real smart in the moment, she realizes she can get to the gun, and she leaps up, grabs the gun, and just blows away one of the guys. And you're like, oh, awesome. Like, this is about to turn for the better. And then the film pauses, and it's just like, that's not how this should go. And then it literally, you hear the villain's voice, and it literally rewinds. And then she goes to leap for the gun, and he grabs it first. And you're like, hold on, what the fuck? It was like kind of the movie. My guess was it was the movie's way of showing, like, we're actually supposed to be watching from the villain's perspective. But that's just my thought. But, like, that's kind of what I was thinking of when she did the whole scene where she was just talking, the whole prep talk scene where she played out all the scenarios. That was the first thing that came to my mind. She was like, I can't run, because she got shot in the leg with an arrow. So she was like, I can't run. He'll catch me. And then it just showed him catch her and all of that. So I was like, oh, that's, like, kind of a funny callback to that.
Yeah. I mean, it's also interesting how a lot of the stuff, for behind the scenes purposes, it was interesting how, even though the script was written, they were changing the script while filming too. Like at one point, not while filming, while they were writing the script. I read an article that said that how Mike and Kate were both acting out scenarios, and if it worked, if it looked good, or like for narrative reasons, they would put it in the script the same day, which I thought was pretty interesting. Like, that was actually really cool. Like, in a way, the film kind of was based off improv. And then once it was finalized, It was just directed, acted out, and released. So I thought that was very, like, interesting. Like, I never heard a movie that does that before. You know, where it's acted out first, then written down, and then produced. Like, that's a first for me.
I'm guessing it's one of the advantages of having, like, such a small cast to work with. It's probably something like that, because It's just five people. Five people, so a lot of people in general, you know. It's funny how I was thinking about this the other day, just a random side, but I was like, it's funny how we kind of minimalize, like, numbers now. Like, as a society, we just kind of look at numbers differently. Like, somebody could go online and be like, I have 100 followers. And they're like, that's nothing. Another person's like, I have 1,000 followers. You're like, that's nothing. It's like, I have 1,000,000. It's like, that's a lot. It's like, dude. 100 people is a lot of people in one space. Like, if you had 100 followers on anything and they all showed up to something, that's a lot of people. But so it's just funny that people kind of do that with numbers. But yeah, five people in the cast, that's, doesn't sound like a lot, but that's still kind of like quite a few people to kind of direct around. But the majority of the film is the killer and Maddie. So I guess it is probably easier to just be like, let's change this, or let's try that, because it's the same two people for the, like, 90% of the film. So I guess that's one of the good advantages, is working with small groups like that.
I mean, not just that, it's also an indie film too. And you know, most indie films don't get the same amount of budget as a Hollywood film. So they're always having constraints. And to be honest, I know we have always had this conversation before in other episodes and even off, you know, recording. I do prefer indie films because they're able to do things that Hollywood films can't, in terms of, like, subject matter and censorship. So many Hollywood films are always censored or constrained because, well, this isn't going to advertise or reach the certain audience we're trying to reach, whereas an indie film, it's hit or miss depending who you are, but it's literally for everyone. It's for all audiences, regardless of criticism or not.
Kinda. Like, my understanding anyway, I've always felt like, well, not even just felt like, from my understanding in general of, like, Hollywood big films, not even blockbuster, just, like, let's say quote unquote mainstream films, like, because they have bigger budgets and stuff like that, I've always, at least my understanding was, they're trying to catch everyone. It's like a giant net to catch any fish. Like, they're trying to catch anyone because they've invested so much money into it. The way they feel most comfortable getting their money back, as if they just, they don't even, like, pick an audience. They're just like, this is for everyone. Kind of like, the best example I could think of is, like, superhero movies. Not all, but, like, specifically, like, the Marvel ones. Like, the Marvel films, like, and this isn't to say that they're bad. I'm not saying that they're bad. But, like, Marvel movies are clearly made for all audiences. So, like, you know, there's only, like, a certain level of violence, a certain level of a lot of things you'll see, even, like, themes or maturity that they show in their films and in their TV shows, because they're under the umbrella of, like, Disney, and then they're under the umbrella of, like, this needs to be appealing to everyone. I don't know if they'll change that going forward in any way, but for, like, they clearly have, like, a line with a lot of their properties where they're like, you can go this far, but at this point, I'm going to need you to pull back, because this is supposed to be for kids, teenagers, adults, people in their 20s, like, mm-hmm. they're trying to catch everybody. And that's why, you know, their budgets be like $900 million and shit. Whereas, like, yeah. an indie film, I feel like with indie films, they kind of, indie films have the luxury. But indie films have almost, like, the luxury of, like, finding their audience. Mm-hmm. Like, they can kind of, like, get the time to, like, develop into, like, who this is actually for. Because, like, mm-hmm. even a film like this, right, like, I don't know who I would say the audience is. Like, I guess horror lovers, sure, but, like, I wouldn't say the audience was, like, specifically women for this kind of movie. I wouldn't say that at all. So I feel like it's kind of finding his home. Like, is the audience people who are deaf? Is the audience people who are mute? Like, it's kind of finding, mm-hmm. it gets the luxury of, like, finding who it's for over time. And I guess that's how films are falling into, like, a cult classic kind of space. But that's just how I kind of view it. You get what I mean?
I get what you mean. And then to add on to what you said about is it for deaf people or mute people, despite how, I mean, for us, we enjoyed it. We thought it was great as horror lovers. But there were people who did kind of give this film a lot of criticism because, you know, Kate Siegel is not deaf or mute. She's an able-bodied woman. And so some people who were born that way kind of felt that whenever she would talk in ASL or the way she would interact didn't feel genuine because she wasn't born that way. While some others were just like, well, I thought she did pretty good. You know, I thought she tried her best. You know, she did this. Because Kate Siegel has said to how she did amounts of research. And this is before they had a consultant on set to help her navigate, mm-hmm. like, how would a person like this act and live, which is similar to what they did with Daredevil, both versions, Ben Affleck and Charlie Cox version, oh, where snap. They had
Ben Affleck? That's a throwback.
Yeah, throwback. Before he was Batfleck.
yeah, but, Ben Rings, yeah, Black Kingpin.
Let's go. Yeah. But yeah, so like they had an actual consultant on set to help him navigate how a blind person will be if this was in real world, you know, in the real world. Reality, and similar to Bird Box, you know, and the same thing with Advent, you know, Calendar and other films where they have someone, an able-bodied person playing someone who is blind, deaf, or mute, who can't walk or anything. They always have someone on set to be like, well, this is how it will be, this is how it feels. But despite that, people still felt like it wasn't genuine, that they felt that it was just another film kind of glorifying, you know, a disability, which I don't think it did. But again, I'm an able-bodied person. I'm not blind. I'm not mute. I'm not deaf. You know, I have my senses, so I can't really say anything on that. But when the film came out, I believe this is also when The Quiet Place came out as well, or a year after A Quiet Place came out. And even the actress who played Reagan, like, she also kind of put her two cents on the film as well. And she is someone who's actually deaf. That's her actual disability. Like, she was born that way. And, you know, even though Kate Siegel and Mike Flanagan did say that, you know, we're sorry, we'll learn a lesson, which we do hear a lot of people say whenever they're portraying a character that is not who they are, in a sense. Like, they weren't born that way. So why are you playing a character like that? She said, the actress played Reagan, Millicent Simone, I think was her name, she said that how, like, you can't really do enough research if you're not living that lifestyle, and it's hard to experience it to have it seem real. That's literally what she said based on Kate Siegel's performance. And a lot of people said that about her performance too, where they were like, we appreciate it, but it doesn't feel real. It doesn't feel like we relate to this in some sense, whereas her character in Quiet Place, a lot of people are just like, wow, a deaf person? Holy crap. You know, because we always talk about representation, how people feel that they're being seen. And yes, we have movies like this. I'm sure many people did feel seen and felt empowered because she was able to turn the tables and the upper hand of her attacker, kill him, and survive. But then you have that other small amount of people that were just like, we appreciate this, but... You know, and there's always that but to it. So, what do you think about that?
I, you know, You can't make everybody happy a lot of the times, and people's views on like even why it's why a situation like this is negative are totally valid. Like, it's definitely something you hear even when you get in terms of like race, culture. Like, how many times have you seen like Hispanic people go, "This isn't how we're going to be viewed," like, or "We don't want to be viewed," or how you see LGBTQ people go, I don't like this portrayal of us. Like, I'd rather be viewed like this versus that. You know, like, it, you've seen that all throughout, like, this genre specifically. We even got to get into like other genres, but this genre specifically, everyone's always said, I would prefer to be viewed like this, or I would prefer that you get someone who's lived this experience to act like this. You know, even people even criticized Daniel Kaluuya for playing Chris in Get Out. I think Samuel Jackson was one of the people too. He was just like, yo, he's like a British black dude. Like, he's not African American from America, but the character that you have portraying here is clearly African American. Like, it's a black person from America. So, like, why would you do that? So, like, people are going to always complain about the representation. And I'm not saying complain is like a negative thing. Like, oh my God, these people need to shut up. That's just the word that best fits what I'm saying.
So, I think it's just criticism.
It's criticism. Yeah, it's criticism. Like, you always going to face that in some way. And I agree with the people. Like, it was funny. You mentioned The Girl from the Quiet Place, because I remember when I saw The Quiet Place, which was actually fairly recently, because I waited hella late to see the first one. I saw the first one, like, after the weekend that the second one came out. But seeing it, I didn't know the little girl was deaf, because I didn't look at me behind the scenes or nothing like that. So I had no idea. I just went into the movie like, oh, it makes sense that these people are doing sign language. Like, the world functions like this. This is just what it is. So I didn't even consider that she actually was until I think later you told me something. I was like, oh, that makes it even more authentic. But I could totally kind of see where she's coming from. Like, not this is a spoiler or anything, but like, you know, A Quiet Place, the family is very well versed in like living with living with a deaf child. Like, the whole family knows sign language and stuff like that. And this version of it, in this version that we watch in Hush, it's like the lead character, this was something that she learned over time. Like, you know, she had the problem. I'm assuming she didn't know ASL before she got meningitis and all of this stuff. So she's learning on the fly. Her family and friends are learning on the fly. So it's different kind of experience, but I can totally get where they're just like, we don't get enough. It's that argument of, and I've had this argument with people about even like the way Black Panthers are viewed in different movies, where it's an argument of, we don't get enough chances, so when you do show us properly. That's really what the debate is at the end of the day. It's like, we don't have many like disabled heroes. So for the few that you do show, can you show them in a way that we can approve of? You know, the people from that community. Mm-hmm. That's really what the debate is at the end of the day. And you can never get mad at that. It's like, yeah, they got a point. She has a point. I don't know. Maybe you could have asked a consultant to push you on other things, or maybe you only asked a consultant to push you on certain things. I know they had the director and all of them, they apologize, but at the end of the day, you know, everybody apologizes when they fuck up. And I mean, like, in the entertainment space, everybody just goes, my fault, I'll do better. And then, unfortunately, all you have to rely on is the hope that they'll do better in the future. Like, you can't really hold them to it. So, so I can't really blame anything that anyone's saying from either side. I get it. He probably hired Katie Sigu because he was like, she's a great actress. I want her to work on this. She's fantastic. That's probably as far as he thought it. He was like, he's probably like, I'm going to get some criticism for this, but I really want her to do this role because she's good. The people watching it are like, this is like the first time in a while I've seen somebody disabled. Yeah, I can't get somebody who's actually disabled. Like, come on, bro. So there's no winning here. There's really no winning here.
Yeah. I mean, it's true because, I mean, despite all the criticism and the fact that they couldn't get an actual person who experienced that, who had senses and then lost them all, the story was still interesting. I'm not gonna say that it's not. It was still interesting. It was very suspenseful. I mean, even an article I read, Mike, and I love how he said it, because it's something I feel like a lot of people in the horror community have been talking about, even on Twitter. Horror Twitter people have been having this debate about jump scares. Do we need them? Do we not need them? And he has said that how, like, he feels jump scares and loud noises don't do anything. They may scare you for those 2 seconds, But then you leave the movie theater being like, well, that wasn't really scary. That wasn't really this. Because you expect it. For this, yeah. He took that and then changed it. And it was just like, no. I want to get you scared by taking all of that away. So you're hearing what she's hearing. You're going through it through her way. Again, props to the sound editing. He did such a... Whoever they were, they said they did such a great job. Because again, I have not been this terrified watching a suspenseful home invasion film since Black Christmas. And that movie scared the shit out of me. And this movie, I was literally clenching my chest so many times when he was trying to get in. Each time she was trying to find a way to get out, he kept popping in. Like, I was literally terrified for her. They did such a good job with it where it's like, yeah, I agree with him. Sometimes it does work depending what the movie is. Sometimes. But most of the time, we don't need it. I don't need it. And a lot of people have said it before. It's like, it's not necessary. Especially when you're doing it like, jump scare here, jump scare here, jump scare, like you're Oprah. Like, you're going to jump scare. You're going to jump scare. There is, like, and you know, it's true. Like, there's a fine line of how execute a jump scare correctly where it literally scares the shit out of you. And you remember it when you leave that theater instead of being all like, eh. It was okay.
Yeah, I think, and you know what? That wasn't something I expected to read when I was pulling through that article where he was talking about, like, you know, kind of the art of scaring people, or at least how his style of doing it and his process. Mm-hmm. That wasn't something I expected to read, but I really did like the way he spoke about it, where he said everything you said, but also he was like, what I kind of felt like what he was saying at the heart of it was like, studios have kind of trained audiences to like look for the jump scares. Like, they've kind of trained them to say, hey, the actual fear of this movie is the jump scare. Yeah, there's crazy shit happening, but the part you should be scared of is when we like involuntarily just randomly surprise you with a ooh, or like something goes thump or some shit like that. Like, that's what should scare you. And he was like, I don't even think that's the most effective way to scare someone. And it's funny, he said I don't think that's the most effective way to scare someone, because your film should be doing is inviting the audience to create their own monster. That's kind of what he's basically saying. Because he said whatever they conjure in their mind will probably be far more terrifying than anything you can explicitly show on screen. Because, you know, there's a limitation to what you can show. But he said what your audience can conjure up about the situation in their mind is probably far more terrifying than what you can display. And he's kind of saying you're creating the environment for them to create their own monster. And I was like, that's really cool. I like that he said that. And I remember, I believe Alfred Hitchcock actually said something similar. I forgot which movie he was working on when he said it. But he said something similar as well. He was just like, no monster I'll put on screen will ever be scarier than the stuff that people are watching create. And I was like, oh, that's kind of cool that somebody remembered that in some capacity and kind of brought that through. Because he's right. Like, I don't hate jump scares. Don't get me wrong. Jump scares can get you. Sometimes to the point, they've been doing jump scares for so long in horror movies to the point that now we do double jump scares, right? Like, we do the fake out jump scare, and then we do the actual scare. Sometimes you do the double fake out jump scare. Sometimes you do the triple fake out. Sometimes you do the quadruple fake. Like, think about having different movies do that stuff. You can see a movie where, I don't know, somebody walks into a room, they see somebody, they see another person, and just because they were so scared on edge, they jump. And they're like, oh my God. Then the other person jumps like, oh my God. But then they both laugh because they're like, oh, there's nothing here. And then something jumps out and stabs somebody. Like, we've seen a million different variations of like jump scares like that, but I did like that he was just kind of like, you should kind of invite the audience to create their own monster, and you should kind of build the tension that creates the actual fear instead of relying on a jump scare to like get people to actually be scared. Because he was like, now people go to see horror movies, and if there are no jump scares, then people walk out like that wasn't scary. And I'm like, I feel like for those people, you just had the worst movie experience, because most of the movies that kind of got me have never had don't have jump scares, or at least I can't remember them. Like, when we did Audition and I was talking about how much that movie freaked me out, I can't recall any jump scares in that movie off the top of my head, but I can recall very specifically the things about that movie that freaked me out and that had me sitting on my couch looking at the TV like, yo, what the fuck is unfolding? Like, that had nothing to do with jump scares. So I appreciate that he feels that way.
And that's why I said, like, it depends. If you're doing a haunted house movie, jump scares sometimes work. Sometimes they don't. but sometimes they do. And this is before Mike Flanagan did the House on Haunting, the House on Haunting Hill, I think it was Haunted called. Hill? Yeah, House on Haunting Hill, the Netflix show, and also he did the sequel, the Haunting of Bly Manor. And I didn't know that until I saw the whole like list of like who worked on the film, who directed it, who wrote it, who co-wrote it, and whatnot. So it makes sense that he had Kate Siegel because she's also in the series as well. And that's why I said, I wrote my notes, like, I like her because she's a really good actress. Like, her performance as Theo in House on Haunting Hill was just wow. Like, so many people have praised her performance because she really is an amazing actress where you feel what she feels, you're feeling it. And it's very rare when actresses or actors can do that, where they make you feel that pain. And some can do that so well that you're just there, like, you're with them, you're rooting for them, you're scared for them, you're crying with them, you're happy with them, you're in love with them. Like, if they're in love, you love that they're in love. Like, very few actors and actresses can do that. And that's a powerful thing most people can do. And she has that talent. So it makes perfect sense knowing that now, because he did write it and Kate Siegel co-wrote Hush, but he has a way of writing and storytelling that it's so fascinating and interesting that he kind of, it's a home invasion film. Yes, this is what's happening, but he has a way of humanizing things as well. He humanized her in a way that, yes, she has a disability. Yes, she's a woman, but because of it, it made her strong, because she had to learn to do these things and it heightened her senses. And then with the hunter, you know, it drives him crazy because he sees the potential that she is a fighter. And he's, in a way, you kind of see him also being humanized, where he's getting frustrated and tired.
Yeah.
And he's like, what is it going to take for me to kill her? What is it going to take for me to break her? And I love that he does that, because he does that as well in House on Haunting Hill and Blind Manor. And for those who have seen it or have not seen it, you have to watch it. It's, the writing is just up there. Like, I've cried a lot with Blind Manor. Blind Manor makes you cry, but it's not like a depressing cry. It's more of just like, I needed to cry. I needed to release those emotions. Because he's just that damn good of a writer. Like, so good. And the fact that this was an indie film, low budget, he did what he had to do with it. It entertained you. It made you feel something. I almost choked my saliva.
Yeah, you're right, but, though. I'm happy you mentioned that point about the killer who's feeling looking frustrated. Because I think those are the parts of the movie where I say that it's funny to me. Because from the moment he approached the house, he was very intimidating. Very, very intimidating.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he just killed somebody, like, literally in front of her. She couldn't see it or hear it, but we could see it and hear it. And we're just like, yo. And it was, like, brutal. It wasn't like, you could do anything with different intent, right? You could pick up you could throw a ball with, like, smooth and chill intent. You can get fucking pissed and, like, really, like, rock a ball at the wall, just like, fuck this. Like, you could, but, like, his intent was, and you with him, you can see his intent was clear, right? So, like, even when he killed her friend Sarah, like, he stabbed her, but then it wasn't just him stabbing her. He had to, like, keep stabbing her. Like, he's looking in through the window watching Maddie cooking, trying to cook something, and he's, like, nonchalantly still stabbing her friend. And so he's like, okay, clearly this dude is as cold-blooded as they come. He just doesn't give a fuck. He, like, kind of relishes in it. Like, if you wanted to ask why he's doing it, it's probably because he could. Like, he's probably just that kind of guy. And even when he's threatening her, he's writing on the, she wrote on the window, and Margaret, she was like, hey, I didn't see nothing. I could tell people I ain't see nothing. I could tell people I don't know what's happening. Or, like, you could just leave. I don't even see your face. I don't know what you look like. We good. And then he took his mask off. It's like, well, now you saw my face, right? So, like, now we have a reason. Like, you understand, right? Like, I have to kill you now. Like, he didn't say that, but, like, his face was just so cold about it that you're like, oh, this dude did not have to take his mask off. He really could have just left. But he enjoys this. This is, like, a part of what he does. And it's kind of crazy to see somebody, like, that kind of cold about everything. Because he as time goes on, it almost gets, like, Home Alone-ish. He almost feels cartoonish at times because he gets so frustrated in different moments. Because remember, he told her, I'm not going to come in the house and kill you until you ready to die. Like, until you're begging me to die. So he was just going to torment her. But, like, she wasn't just walking around the house, like, just panicking the whole time. She's really trying to think of ways to get away. And then the one time he nearly stuck his head in the door, she, like, hit him with the back half of the hammer, stuck that shit straight in his arm, which that should have ended the whole night, to be honest, because you can't take that to the arm and just be like, I'm good. But he did, because, you know, it's a movie. So there's that part. But she at no point did she really just lean over like, oh, I need to just let him come in here and just kill me. And I think that was frustrating him as well. It was like, yo, she keep trying new shit. She's not just like crying or whimpering out or hoping that I come in there and end it. She's not giving up. Like, she keeps trying to succeed. As you said, he just can't break her. And he was just getting frustrated every step of the way. First, he gets stabbed with a hammer. Then he loses the goddamn crossbow. And then her friend's boyfriend comes by. And now he has to deal with him. And he's like, this guy's fucking massive. He can't beat him. I can't beat him in a fight. Good thing I caught him off guard. Like, it's just every part of the night for him kept getting worse frustrated. He slashed the car tires. She used the car keys to turn to blare the siren so somebody could hear the noise. And he had to go in there and fucking cut the horn. Like, every step of the way, this dude was just like, kind of unraveling from just being crazy to also just being like, this is annoying. Like, his face was kind of like, I chose to do this because it was going to be fun. This isn't fun anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's also because the fact that he realized, I mean, I like how you brought up the whole when he was stabbing Sarah. That was the most gruesome death I've seen since Black Christmas. I mean, we've seen gruesome deaths in, like, horror films, you know, the whole cliche of, like, you know, the knife being phallic, stabbing to the woman, whatever.
Yeah.
That didn't feel like a phallic thing. That felt of, like, she really can't hear me. Is she not gonna see me? Like,
yeah.
Why aren't you turning? Like, he was, like, in a way, you didn't see it because he had the mask on, but you could tell through his eyes, he was, like, waiting, like, any moment she's gonna fucking turn.
Yeah, like, he wanted to be seen. Turn.
Yeah, like, he wanted to, like, have that whole, like, but he didn't get that. And it was just so gruesome, where it's just like, dude, that's not necessary. Like, he stabbed her, like 15 times over and over and over. Because he wanted the knife to, like, bang on the glass. And then he's banging on it, like, you know, doing this. And you do see hints of blood on the glass, but she can't see it because it's so dark outside. So it just fades with the darkness. And it was just so, like, massive. And I think because the fact that he realized at that moment, she can't hear me. But let me test it again, is when he came in and was, like, you know, like, flicking his knife and talking. And then he notices that she really can't hear me. And then I guess in a way he felt it'll be fun because he was just like, oh, she's deaf and mute. Or, like, she's deaf. I could have fun with this. She can't do anything. She can't escape. She can't call for help. She's useless. I'm going to kill her. But that was his biggest downfall. Because he underestimated her. And she was so resourceful. Yeah, like the car. She had an LED flashing light that she threw across the forest. That he was just like, what is that? The light's flickering. She used the wasp hornet spray on his face. As you know...
That
to block
was
his eyes. That was just...
That was the most casual way I've ever seen somebody get maced in my life.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know how old Maddie is in the present when this is happening. We just know that when she was 13, she lost two of her senses. So we don't know the time space between that and where she is now. We don't know if she's like in her 20s, in her 30s. So with that being said, she has all this amount of years relearning to hone her skills. Relearning to, like, learn how to do sign language, learning how to use her senses in a different way, the breeze, the feel of touch, you know, the taste. She used that to her advantage. And I appreciate the fact that, like, she didn't become, and I love how Mike also said that in an article where he was like, she is not a damsel in distress. I didn't want to do that with this film or the story. That would feel like an insult. And he was right. It would have been so insulting if, like, she was all, like, you know, panicking, freaking out, scary. But no, she was just like, I need to survive any way I can. Even if I die trying, I need to get out of here or kill him in some way. And I really appreciated that because it's so empowering to see a woman like that, that is with a disability, and she's able to turn the tables and be like, oh, you think I'm helpless? Wrong. I'm more stronger than you because I know how to use certain things that you don't even know or you take advantage of, you take for granted. And I love that so much about this movie. Like, that's what I was just like, that was a good fucking movie. Like, wow.
And there you go.
Yes, but yes, so Hush is on Netflix. I don't know how long it's going to stay on because you know how Netflix be. But if you have not watched this film.
Kind of a Netflix movie, I think, kind of.
Is it?
I'm not 100% sure, but I think it's like kind of is.
And Netflix original. Well, if that's the case, then it's going to stay on forever, which is fine. It's definitely a movie that you should watch, you know, despite the criticism, because, you know, subject matter, it's still a great film in terms of story, narrative, the sound. I cannot get over the whole sound editing of, like, score, unscored. Like, it was just so good. And I think someone also said that how, like, it felt like you're watching The Shining, because The Shining did that too. There were certain scenes where there was no sound, just the sound of, like, the hotel. And for here, all you see is, or you hear is the sound of her surroundings. No score, just her, what she's doing. That's just, I love movies do that. It's just so good. Like, thanks for recommending that for me. Like, it's such a good movie.
No problem. And I didn't even have to traumatize you this time.
I know, usually do. I'd be like, fucking Kendall, man. What the fuck? But definitely a good movie. But yes, 10 out of 10. Definitely recommend. Please watch it if you have never seen it. And if you have, hey, let us know what you think. You know, did you think it was good? Did you think it was eh? What do you think about the criticism? And what is your take about, you know, Kate Siegel portraying, you know, a internal deaf woman? But yeah, any last words, Kendall?
Nothing. I was just going to end on silent, just so to freak you out for a moment.
Why?
That is all. I figured I'd get you like the beginning of the movie got me.
Oh my god. I really had to lower my volume after that. I was just like, oh, gotta lower this. Too loud, too loud, too loud. But that was also really clever. Yeah, and props to Blumhouse for like producing this. Props for them for giving Mike Flanagan the green light on it. Like, yeah, we do it. We'll produce it for you. So props to them, man. Blumhouse be that real one, man. That ride or die. It'd be like, oh, you want to do this? I got you, fam. Like,
yeah, they got a lot of good ones, man. I don't know if you ever saw Green Room, but that might be another one I'm going to have to throw your way. That one was really good.
No,
Green
I haven't seen it. Yeah, because Blumhouse, they know. They see the talent. They see it. They give chances. Yeah. They're like, I'll give you a chance. That's cool. But yes, not funny you did that. Because I was about to be like, hello? You hear me? And you'd be like, yeah, I can hear you. I'm like,
yeah, I figured as much. But all right, let's get out of here. Next time, guys.
Hey, talk to you. Yeah, so have a safe Women's History Month, and ooh, ghosts, goodbye.